about how you got. You, Ben, you said you used to just go hang out on the pier.
Yeah, well, initially, when I moved here in 57, I was like 7 years old. And it was then that my father started taking me to the different piers, area piers. And that's how I really, really got started in the, in interest in the fishing. He took me fishing initially. Used to go to a place to eat breakfast, and he would get a side order of bacon on the side, and that wasn't cooked, and he'd take us fishing. We'd make our own poles, and he'd bring the line, the hooks, and we'd go fishing in little streams and catch small fish. That was my first introduction to fishing that I can remember.
What about you, David?
Well, my first fishing experiences were actually in freshwater in Jacksonville, Florida, where I lived with my parents until I was about, I must have been 10, and we moved here. And when we moved here, the accessibility of marine habitats or saltwater canals, beaches, etc., was just great. So I quickly shifted over and started fishing in wherever I could by bicycle. It was usually, I had no family history. My father didn't really fish or anything. I was all on my own. And then I moved to where the same neighborhood where Ben was living, which is right on Little Lake Worth. And then I met him, and all his brothers fished, and I met those guys actually on the beach fishing. And then we continued as we got older. We got a little better at things, and we more mobile, and then we're able to say go to the Juneau Pier, which was my first introduction to big time ocean fishing, if you will, because at that time you could actually catch without any problem. You could catch bonita and jack crevalle and African pompano, tarpon, snook, all the coastal game fishes right there off this little 500 foot wooden pier, and it was the greatest thing in the world for a young kid.
Now, what did you use? You used Paul hooking line? Is that what line is with Paul?
Yeah, it was always a rod and reel that we grew up with. That's how we were initiated into fishing. It was through rod and reel fishing, you know.
And that's with all the old guys on the pier also?
Exactly. It was all hook and line. Just spinning rods and conventional reels also.
Okay, so were there any like multiple lines that way?
No. It was, you'd fish a single bait on one rod and reel.
Now, you've gone into it commercially, right?
Yes.
When did you start doing
that? Oh, I was selling fish from the time I was probably 11 years old, 10 or 11. When we used to go around, and a friend of mine that owns a tackle store in Boca Raton now, he and I used to go around and catch small fishes, pinfishes, spots, sheephead, and we would catch those and put them in our bike baskets and take them and sell them at this fish house for about a nickel a pound, I think it was, and we'd make a couple dollars, which was enough to buy our lunch, and then have enough money to buy our tackle for the weekend, and that was how I initially got into it. And also we would fish by the area fish houses, and we would watch the boats come in and unload their catches. And in fact, we actually, in the wintertime, at the peak times when they were netting mackerel and bluefish and pompano, we would work at the fish house and pack fish for the fish houses.
What were the major fish houses around?
At that time, there was, where we worked mostly was at Acme, and then there was Hudgens, and there were several other ones. I can't remember the name of the one that was next to Florida Diesel, but there was, what was that, South Florida?
Yeah.
And then Pinder had a place on the water there by...
and there was Hudgens was right there,
and
too.
And Hudgens was always there. We never seemed to get along too well with Hudgens.
Yeah. And David, when did you ever were in it completely?
No, I was always with... Well, for a while, I could... That was my only source of income. While I was both a high school and college student, that's when I was really depending on it. And I actually started selling fish, you know, when I was 12, 13 years old here in Jupiter. Pender's, Clinton Pender Seafood, was right on the water here, right off A1A where the new bridge is. You know, now there's just a lot there. wedding, a condominium or something, and that was great there because there was also a little restaurant there, and I had a small boat, and we would go out and catch snappers and things around the jetties at Jupiter Inlet and bring them in and sell them right at Pender's, and they would give us cash, and we just couldn't stand that, being paid, you know, getting this money for fish. We were having fun just catching them on rods and reels, not really working any harder than we would have if we were just going to take them home and eat them or let them go. But here we were bringing them in and turning a minimum profit and then running right over the restaurant and buying a hamburger with it. But it was the same thing. We would sit on the seawall and watch the professional guys come in and unload their tremendous catches. And at the time, I was always flabbergasted, and I asked them a million questions, and some of them would talk to you, and most of them would, some of them wouldn't. But eventually, you know, we started moving offshore since I had a small boat. My parents had a boat, luckily, and that was some of our first experiences offshore. And we simply used the same methods that we'd learned at Juneau Pier. And central to that was the use of live bait, using live menhaden or sardines, thread herring, etc., goggle eyes. And you had to go through, it was kind of a production for us. It wasn't that big of a production. We've been doing it all along. We just had to put together a system to keep them alive in the boat, carry them offshore, and it was the catches we made using live bait and just our standard hooks with no fancy sinkers or hardware on them. It was just a hook and a leader and a live bait. We wouldn't even troll them. This is when the offshore sport fishermen were mostly trolling dead bait.
What's
value.
Trolling? What is trolling?
That's you know, going at a slow speed. Well, now it could be anywhere from, I don't know, what's 5 knots down to just barely a crawl, where you're dragging the bait behind the boat. And that's trolling. You're pulling the bait, and you can cover lots of area. It's probably one of the most popular. Trolling, not trawling.
Okay, what is
trawling? Is fishing with a net. That's how they catch shrimp. It's a bottom or a midwater or a surface trawl.
I remember Simonet saying trawling, and I thought he was saying trawling.
He was probably trolling because that's right. The major way. He has never fished with live bait. Mm-hmm. You know, that he has always trolled to catch his king mackerel. Mm-hmm.
Now, who are some of the people that you best talked with, and what kinds of things were you asking?
You mean like the commercial fishermen that we saw?
Yeah, the people you talk with on the pier.
Well, the pier people were mostly people that, like from Pratt Whitney and things, you know, they wouldn't fish all that often on the pier. We were like pier rats. In the summertime, I would be there every day. My father was working in Stewart. He'd drop me off at 6 in the morning, pick me up at 6 at night. And we just learned the habits of all the fish that came to the pier and knew how to catch everything. Like David said about the live bait, that was central to our fishing because the large schools of bait congregated around the pier for protection from the pelagic species that would come in at intervals to feed on them. And we learned how to catch, the big thing was snook back then, when there were a lot more snook than there are now. And there would be big schools of snook that would lay out around the pier, and we would learn different ways to actually make a fish bite. You know, instead of just at a certain time when they wanted to feed, you would have to make a fish bite. By presenting them a bait that they just could not refuse with a real light leader and a real small hook.
So who are the people you were asking the questions to? Like, is it fish houses?
I was talking about the fish house. Guys like Guy Freeman, who died a couple years back, and his brother Lewis, Bob Minot, Nolan Blue, and there was a host of them. You know, where'd you catch them? What'd you catch them on?
Yeah.
Just, you know, a kid, they among themselves, they probably, some of them are a little tight-lipped about them. You have to be anymore. And, but I think with kids, you know, most of them would be, they kind of laughed us off. You know, here comes those kids with the rods and reels again when we actually started selling stuff. You know, and so, oh, you guys did good today, and they'd pat you on the head. And I think, and then as the years went on, we got into kingfishing with live bait and proved that we could catch twice as many as they could given in about half the time, in given the right situation. they suddenly change their attitude toward us.
When we sort of welcome, we ever...
Well, some of them never really. I think some of them recognize, you know, how hard you work and the time you put in, and they respected that. But other ones, particularly, I think it was guys that maybe didn't do so well anyway, would be very put out at people who weren't fishing by their traditional methods.
What were their traditional methods?
Trolling, mostly trolling using a wire line, which it's an ingenious way of catching the king mackerel. That's what we're talking about now, is king mackerel. It's wireline, what, piano wire or welding wire, with a homemade jig on it, which consists of just a hook with some, I think back then they just used polypropylene from a rope.
They used
polypropylene rope wired on it, like a giant version of a freshwater fly that they used to catch trout with. And using the wire line, it doesn't require any weight or anything to get down, so it actually would get down to where the fish really were, you know, depending on how much of this line you let out. And then they troll slow and jig it. So it's akin to sport fishing techniques, and you have to be talented to catch fish that way. You can catch a few just by blindly dragging it around, but the guys who were good at it always do well. But it was easy enough that if you had a boat set up for that sort of fishing, it was easy enough for a guy to buy one of these boats fully equipped and jump right in it and go out and catch enough to get by. If there were enough fish around.
Now, were most of these guys from the old conks?
It was a mishmash.
Yeah.
I used to talk to the Revere conks a lot more since I had been down there and worked with them and gone to school with their kids. And also since I sold all my fish to Felix at Acme for a number of years, he was the only one I dealt with. And they were good people. We didn't have too much problems with them. We were pretty much ostracized though when we first started fishing live bait. We were not accepted into the fleet because of the changes and that when they saw that we were starting to catch, you know, a lot of fish and their catches weren't staying, you know, where they should have been, there was some bad feelings in that end. There still are. There's still people today who want to see live bait fishing outlawed. Because it was different, and it may have had an effect in its prime when there were, you know, 50 or 60 live bait boats chumming the fish up. The fish would feed around the boats that had live bait, and the jiggers would not catch as many fish as they used to. When we first started, there was, three or four boats maybe fishing live bait?
Yeah, and we could
and
stay
there was
out of
50
everybody's
or 60,
way.
50 or 60 troll boats. And in a matter of three or four years, there got to be up to 50 live bait boats, and then maybe only 30 trollers. So that it turned completely around from the trollers to the live bait fishers.
Probably it really hit the...
About 6 years ago, 7 years ago?
About 79 to 81
probably was
was when it was really like everybody with an open boat, a couple of rods and reels could go out. There was no regulation for sport. There was no definition by any regulatory agencies of what a sport or a commercial fisherman was. And anybody can unload a big pile of fish and get money for them. So any people found, oh, gee, just go out here and... Now, if you can keep these little sardines alive, you can catch $100 worth of kingfish, which for a guy that works at Pratt Whitney, that's great. Goes out and pays for his beer and his ham sandwiches and stuff, and his fuel. And he has a fun time fishing, And then there were quite a number of serious live baiters, too. In fact, it seemed like the live bait technique was like catching on Miami and south of here. I don't think north of this area there's traditional wireline trolling for king mackerel, and in the Fort Pierce areas, they're starting, or they've historically used the nets up there, which aren't used south of this area for king mackerel, which are now being blamed for any stock declines, whether, you know, it's pretty hard to prove it, but it there seems to be some correlative evidence.
What was in regulation, when were regulations put in that divided the sport fishing from commercial fishing? It seems like there was a while there that everybody could fish, and then it sort of...
That was only recently, really, when they required a...
3 years ago, they initiated, in order to get a king mackerel permit to be able to fish for king mackerel, you had to prove by sending in a tax return or a notarized letter from your accountant, had to prove that you made 10% of your living from selling seafood products. It didn't have to be king mackerel. It could have been anything, but you had to make 10% of your income from commercial fishing. And that actually eliminated about 60% or 70% of the people fishing, because they would only fish when the king mackerel were here. That's the only time of the year they would commercial fish, when it was easier to catch fish. We have two predominant peaks in our fishery now. The first one starts about the third week of April and lasts till the first week of June, and then the fish leave again and they come back in what we call the August run, which is usually about the third week in July and on into the first week of September. We have two peaks in our fishery. We used to have a major winter fishery here. That was what the, for king mackerel, that was the...
That was probably the heyday of...
That was the heyday of fishing in our area for king mackerel, when schools of fish 3 and 4 miles long and a half mile wide would come about the... January, last week of December, first week of January. And they would stay till the first week of March. And that's when most of our king mackerel were caught, was in that time frame, when the fleets were as large as they had ever been, and that was in the 60s. And we lost our winter fish, I think, primarily due to the extensive netting of those fish on the West Coast before they reached our area.
What is a typical day? Can you describe what you do from the time you get up, say, until the time you crawl up the drive?
That's about right. It depends what you're fishing for at the time, but a typical king mackerel day, if you want to fish for the fish in the morning, you'd say get up at about 4:30 in the morning, go, and I have a key to the fish house, so I can go and get my ice. I'll take it over and load my ice into the boat, and usually I'll be fueled up from the day before. So I'll go offshore about daybreak, and usually if I'm going to fish for king mackerel in the morning, I'll troll for them. I won't take the time to catch the live bait. I'll go ahead and troll with the wire line and fish till about noon or 1 o'clock, then come in, eat some lunch, unload my fish if I have a lot of fish. If I don't, I'll just leave them on the boat, and then I'll get ready for the afternoon fishing, which I'll leave about 3 o'clock, go out and catch my live bait in cast nets that we throw by hand. They're about 12 feet long, and they'll open in a 24-foot circle. And you sight the bait, and they're usually in shallow water, about 10 or 12 feet. And we transport them offshore in live bait wells that we have in our boat. They'll have about 18 to 24 holes drilled through our boat in a closed portion of the boat, and the baits are kept alive in those wells. And we transport them out. It's about 3 or 4 miles to where the kingfish stay. And we'll locate them with depth recorders. We'll mark them on the recorders. They'll make little marks on your paper, or if you have a color machine, which I do now, you can see them just like on TV. They make little squiggles on the screen. And when we mark those fish in those areas, we'll stop the boat and start to drift. And we'll put, if two people are fishing, we usually only fish two lines. Rod and reel with about 50-pound test, a small wire leader, and about an 8-0 hook. And we drift along through those areas. When we get a bite, we'll go ahead and throw a couple of the live baits out that we have in the well to keep the fish around. And you can actually chum them. Chumming is throwing bait over to keep them interested. And that's as you go along, as you drift with the Gulf Stream, you go over more and more fish, and sometimes you can make a drift of about 2 or 3 hours and catch about 800 pounds of fish in one drift.
How many fish?
It's about 80 fish, depending on the size of the fish. But average, they're average about 10 pounds in the summertime.
Okay. So you fish from about 3 until?
3 until, depending on the moon phase now, 3 until about dark. Mm-hmm. Usually the fish will stop biting at about dusk. And if the moon is half, usually half towards the full, going on full from the half to the full, we'll go ahead and stay out after dark and go back to the same areas except a little farther offshore and try to catch the fish after dark. They will bite on the moon. They bite very well on the moon sometimes.
Is it they bite according to different phases of the—
Yes, they do.
Can you describe that a little more?
Like the half moon rising all the way to the full moon. From when the moon is half to full is usually the best times. Now, usually 3 days before the full moon was the best time. It seemed to have changed through the years. The full moon was the best time, and then it kept, year after year, it kept reversing itself, like the day before the full moon, and 2 days before, and then 3 days before seemed to be the best. And actually, in the last couple of years, the way the fish bit on the moon has completely changed. They really haven't bit much on the moon like they used to. When you used to see a fleet of 300 or 400 boats out there at night fishing on the moon. And the fish were easier to catch at night because you don't have to have live bait. At night you can switch over to a dead sardine instead of using live bait, because live bait can be troublesome to catch at times. And you drift the dead sardine back with the current, and sometimes with a small lead of about 1 ounce, sometimes without it. And what we do is chop up sardines and throw the chunks of sardines over as we drift, similar to throwing the live bait over in the daytime, which chums the fish up and keeps them around the boat. And a typical drift on the moon, usually not like the daytime, they're usually a little bit harder to keep around the boat. You might catch 12 to 18 fish on a drift and then move back, depending how fast the current was going.
So basically you could be out, huh?
You could be out till... Usually the fish slow down on their bite when the moon is directly overhead. So that's usually, it depends what phase of the moon on how long you're going to be out. Some nights you'll be in at 11, and then 12, 1, 2, as the moon progresses. Stays up longer, you know, each night it gets towards the full, it stays up longer. And then you have more time till it gets to directly overhead. When we finish, we come in, we bring, take the fish, and each fish has to be gutted. That's all it has to be done, is you make a small slit underneath the fish and remove its intestines. And then the fish are, on my dock, we have to put them in like wheelbarrows and take them to the truck. And then since I do have a key to the fish house, I would take my fish to the fish house there and weigh them and ice them in individual boxes or put them in a big cooler, depending on where they were going, whether they were going to be sent to New York or whether they were going to go to Miami, depending on what we did with them.
And then they're taken care of by somebody else, the fish house, in terms of ship.
Right, and yes, the next day they would see the weights we had, and then they would, you know, ship them accordingly to whoever wanted the fish.
What's a day like for you when you go out?
He just described it. I mean,
same,
I'd be with him, yeah.
Okay,
yeah. You'd need a minimum of 2 people to do all that. Although you can do it by yourself, I guess.
The boat I have right now is a 26-foot custom-made open fisherman, I would call it. It's open all the way around except in the bow. I have a small cuddy cabin. It's a center console directly over the motor. It is an inboard. And I have a small tower on the boat, which you can go in the tower and you can spot the bait more easily. It's powered by a 653 Detroit diesel motor, and it really works well. It has the live bait well is in front of the motor where we keep the bait. It's worked out real well for us.
So you have a lot of wells and areas that you can store.
Exactly. Yeah, the fish, we have a 1,000-pound box in the stern, which will hold 1,000 pounds, and I've got a box forward. It'll hold about 500 pounds, and usually I go in when we catch that many fish. I don't like to keep fish out. In those boxes, they'll all be iced. They'll be, and if there's not quite enough ice to ice them, I usually add some water and chill them, like put them in ice water to get the temperature down as low as we can. But some nights when the fish are biting, I'll go ahead and catch another 200 pounds and put them on the deck, which makes the maximum night that I'll usually have at about 1,700 pounds, which you might only have two of those a year.
Yeah. regulated in terms of the way you can catch?
The way we are regulated is by a total quota for all commercial fishermen. The daily catch rates are not regulated in federal waters. Now, in state waters, last year they initiated a 50 fish limit, which inside of 3 miles, if you're fishing inside of 3 miles, you can only have 50 king mackerel on your boat.
Because I know that the oysters,
king mackerel, they really don't. They don't even have a size limit on king mackerel. In fact, it's fairly.
They proposed one.
They had one proposed. They had one. Even Florida had one when Florida was in charge of all its regulations, within and without its waters. Florida had a size limit for a time, but it was repealed also, mainly because a number of small king mackerel are caught in gill nets set for Spanish mackerel, and the size limit would have really hurt the netters at a certain times when there's a lot of king mackerel mixed with the Spanish.
Now, so where do you use standard fish hooks?
Yes.
And everything pretty much depends on you can get any.
Right. Any tackle store you can buy.
Okay. What about the nets? Are any of those hand baited anytime?
The ones we buy, I buy my nets from. A man of West Palm who makes them specifically for the kind of fishing we do. We have to, our mesh, the mesh size is 1 inch stretch. The bars on the net are 1 inch, and the nets typically have about 14 to 16 pounds of lead on them.
What's this net maker's name?
Jack Fondero.
Fondero. Now does he get like the webbing?
Right.
Sell them straight up.
No, he orders the webbing from Japan and then makes the nets to order.
Are there any from scratch cast net makers that you really make them from scratch?
It's too time consuming to make a net. You know, it's just too easy to buy the webbing and cut the panels and make the nets. A couple of my friends have made them, you know, one or two nets, but that's it.
Yeah, I think that, I can't remember his name, but the guy, first cast net I got from Bob, remember those nylon
Tony,
nets?
The
Frenchie,
yeah. I guess.
Guy with the, walked with limp, I think he handmade those things from scratch, because they took forever for him to make them. But these were little ones, too. This one, as a kid, I had one that was, you know, 5 feet in radius.
Do you find... One of the things I mentioned about Simmons when I said something about superstitions, but they just didn't believe that. Did you at any time grow up around any superstitions around fishing that you remember? Like, for example, not saying trimming nets. Some people say you shouldn't say alligator when you're on a boat and things like that.
The only superstition I had was never say the boat was running good.
Right.
Never say the boat was running good.
Oh, really?
Never because discuss anything about how the mechanical operation of the motor
boat,
is.
The boat was running. Because
no sooner would that get out of your mouth than something
would
happen.
You know, somebody would ask
yeah,
if it's so happened
we, yeah, it happened a couple of times. So we finally just don't say that.
Don't say anything about the motor.
But that's a tongue-in-cheek
people would ask
superstition.
You, yeah, it was tongue-in-cheek, but someone would ask you.
It was almost haunting.
It was haunting.
And we... the only things along those lines I've heard is people, some guys will say, never gut your fish offshore. That's not necessarily a superstition, but it's sort of maybe a logical practice. Don't gut your fish. Like if you're anchored, if you've been kingfishing, it's common to anchor the boat and gut your fish. And while you're doing that, you throw a bottom line out for snapper or grouper. And they'll say, don't gut your fish or... You know, throw even your snapper. Don't throw any entrails over there because you'll scare all the fish. You'll never catch another fish there. Hmm. When really the opposite is probably true. You know, you attract things to them. I've heard stuff like that, but that's.
Now, where did you learn about the phases of the moon?
It was all our own knowledge that we found out about that. We actually initiated the fishing on the moon. The trollers would go out maybe once or twice near the full moon. And try and troll for fish with spoons, but that they really didn't do it as a you know, as something that they counted on to catch fish. We learned about the moon from actually area drift boats that would go out, and we knew that they caught fish on the moon, but they didn't go fishing very often. They would fish like, if they fished Mondays, Wednesdays, and Saturday nights or Friday nights, maybe two or three times a week, and then you would hear that they would have good catches on the moon. So I just took that, and you know, knowing that the fish bit on the moon, I kept going to see where the fish went, because the fish do move during the day. They have their different patterns of movement. In the morning, they'll usually be in about 110 to...
curious about is, what, you got the weather, that always makes for good fishing.
Or what bad, else? Or you can't get out.
Yeah, oh yeah. But what else makes for good fishing?
Lunar phases are one of the biggest things in fishing. Most fish feed better on a rising moon, no matter, you know, it doesn't have to be a kingfish. Snapper, grouper, from half to full moon is the best time of the month to fish, the lunar month.
Yeah, that's all often associated, yeah, it's often associated with, you know, that certain species tend to aggregate to spawn. Mm-hmm. During certain lunar phases, whether it's new moon, full moon, or in between, as he's discussing in between, and then that concentrates them for the fishermen. And in certain island areas, it's really pronounced. Say, in fact, a fellow has written a book on, it's sort of a native lore type book on Micronesia in Palau, you know, way over in the middle of the Western Pacific. And these natives had it scientifically determine just about the activities based on lunar phases of all their target species, and they told him with great precision, you know, well, you can, during this lunar phase of this month, you can take your canoe and go over here and there'll be this species, kind of an analogy, and that seems to apply here for the most part in the Bahamas, lots of places. You know, you can talk to natives that'll say, you know, and they immediately start telling you about the moon. So it's just, if you're around long enough to observe these things and see the pattern, the regularity of it. Although here it changes a little bit, however, the actual arrival, say, of the king mackerel corresponds very well with the moon. And then there's something to do, as he's been mentioning, about their feeding activity related to the actual, if it's the light or whatever, but as the moon gets from new to full, you know, there seems to be sort of an extended period which they'll feed up until somewhere around the full moon. It seems like often they'll cease, and maybe that's when they're spawning. That's been our assertion, that maybe right around the full moon they quit feeding, because oftentimes the catch will drop off abruptly right about near or just after the full moon. And you think, well, when they're spawning, they're not feeding, so fishing is not necessarily as good then.
You're in a slack time now, but it wasn't that slack earlier in the August, right? So when will it pick up again?
Well, we keep talking, we've talked mostly, in fact, almost exclusively about king mackerel.
Yeah.
As far as king mackerel are concerned now, I won't be, there'll be probably be a few fish here in late January and February as far as king mackerel, but I'll, you know, I've already started snapper fishing, going back to catching snapper, which I do right along when there's king mackerel too, and also grouper. The grouper season we have usually starts in January and goes to March, which is the gray grouper, which is, again, is like we're talking about aggregations. It comes in to spawn and comes in schools, which we locate with the depth finders also. And that's another fishery that we fish with live bait. We catch our live bait, but instead of drifting, we anchor on the rocky areas where they come to spawn, and we fish a bait on the bottom, a live bait.
So we have the snapper, basically.
Snapper, grouper, king mackerel. Those are the major three. And now we've developed a market in the last 4 years for amberjack, and that's getting to be. It's really saved me, especially this year with not having many king mackerel. It's really supplemented my income a lot, and I'm going to continue on that vein to try and, you know, keep finding amberjacks, because they come in the summertime in droves, you know, and when they're real thick, the market isn't that good on them. But when they start dispersing, they start dispersing in July, and they're dispersed now. Last year I started catching them in October in a place where nobody else had really fished for them. And I'm going to be back there in another week or so to check and see if they've come back this year too. And I got a good price for them all last winter, and I'm hoping to do the same this winter.
When you prepare to go fishing, what do you do?
Usually I make my rigs on my boat, but some of the rigs catching live bait in the wintertime is completely different than the summer. In the summertime, the bait fish migrate down from the north and stay in close to the beach where they spawn. And in the wintertime, those fish move back up north and offshore out into the deeper waters. So we actually have to go to a different kind of bait. So we fish with goggle eyes and blue runners, which we have to get up early, like at 4 in the morning. And we go out and fish with like 10 little jigs on a line and a heavy sinker on the bottom, and we locate the fish with a depth recorder, and we drop these down to the bottom and have to catch each one by on hook and line instead of on a cast net. And then when we have enough bait at about daylight, we go out to the certain depths. Usually this time of the year, if we want to fish for amberjacks, we'll go out to about 250 to 300 feet and fish in that depth. And there I use an electric reel with wire line and a heavy sinker, anywhere from 2 to 6 pounds. Leaders are about 10 to 12 feet long, and the hook is the Japanese circle hook, which works very well in deep water, because once you hook the fish on it, they stay on it very well. Right. Usually try and get in the afternoon before the gas station closes, but if you don't, then the next morning, along with getting your ice, you'll have to go, and I'll fill 2 20-gallon containers full of fuel, and I'll tote that down the dock and fuel up on the dock, so I won't, you know, so I won't have to wait till the gas station opens, because then you miss your bait and you miss your whole day. It's the same thing when you get back to the dock. The fish are gutted and unloaded and taken to the fish house. Packed, usually by you, because at that time the fish house is usually closed.
I was at Acme and I was watching them pack fish, and I still didn't understand. Yeah, basically it was a matter of bending the fish
into the box. Yeah, it is.
And that's really it, isn't it?
That's why they'll often, with king mackerel, they don't want to pay a good price for the bigger fish, because they can't put them in a box and ship them to New York, where it brings the price, and it results in a cutoff, you know, size. And it's not just because that size fish is any, the palatability or whatever is any different. It's just, it wouldn't fit in a box.
Because I was watching one woman, you know, I thought, you know, fish had a back to break. She didn't.
Yeah.
Wrap that thing in. I was really kind of surprised, because I thought, wouldn't that spoil the fish?
It would probably bruise the fish somewhat if it was overly contorted to get in a box. I don't really think it would make that much of a difference in the palatability, as long as it wasn't left for any length of time.
Yeah, those things are sold pretty quickly. Yeah. I think that's. But you're right. Maybe that would affect it if it was sitting on the shelf for a while.
What is the shelf life of the fish?
Ask the seafood market owner here. Tell her the real.
It depends on the fish. Fish with more oil, like a king mackerel or a dolphin, don't last as long. They're max at about a week to 10 days at max. Now, you can take a white fish like a snapper, a grouper, and as long as it's taken care of when it gets into the boat, if it's iced immediately, you can keep that fish in your store for 2 weeks whole. Once you cut the fish, you have a maximum of 3 days to sell it, because the fillets, once the meat touches the air and is exposed to the bacteria in the air, and your hands handling it, it will spoil in about 3 days.
Where's your fish house now?
It was Jupiter Seafood on Old Dixie Highway. I sold it in last December to one of the partners that I was in with, in the business with. Steve Dunning is the owner of that now.
What makes your bad fishing precisely?
cold water intrusions?
Cold water is a big thing about that. I'll let David explain it. He knows a little bit more.
It's just an oceanographic condition, because out here we have a unique situation in that the Gulf Stream is so close to shore. It's another thing that contributes to the good fishing off this part of Florida. And occasionally the Gulf Stream doesn't just run in a straight line, it does a lot of meandering. It's just like a river or a stream. And sometimes, and this is an assertion, but they have been collecting some current meter data and some oceanographic data to sort of support these ideas. But anyway, when the current bends off, say off the shore, as you get into one of these oxbows, if you will, it tends to cause deeper, colder water that's just off of the shelf out here, which is, this is the edge of the actual continental shelf, which is the geological formation. You know, when the sea level, millions of years ago, when the sea level was way down, it was like the old beach line. Mm-hmm. Anyway, down here, off this part of Florida, it's much closer to shore than it is anywhere else along the East Coast. Mm-hmm. And the Gulf Stream tends to track that old shoreline for good ways. So anyway, when the Gulf Stream itself bends offshore, we get this sort of an upwelling, they call it, of cold, deep water that moves up onto the shelf, and it'll move in pockets, or just a cold water mass will move in, and then it will actually create its own little gyre, they call it, or a little eddy, a spin-off kind of a current that'll actually run counter to the Gulf Stream. Say it'll run south. You'll be in it in your boat. You'll be anchored, and you suddenly notice you're pointing south, which is completely different than the norm, which is the Gulf Stream's always running north. Well, that happens quite often out here, really. And
in the summer,
satellite pictures show these things too. These little pinch off eddies from the Gulf Stream. It'll pinch off and tend to go to spin the other direction, so that the effect is, if you're in one of these things, that the current is going south, you can go 10 miles north of where you are and the current's going back the normal direction. So it's really, there's really quite a bit of variability out here, and some of that, these current changes, will affect the fishing too. But mostly the cold water seems to really...
How cold do you get?
I don't know.
52 is the coldest I ever heard.
52 Fahrenheit from a diver's measurement.
It gets so cold that it'll start killing some of the fish that haven't migrated out of the path of them. It'll start killing some of your small tropicals like angelfish first. Angelfish and cornets?
Yeah, cornet fish.
Cornet fish are affected.
Moray eels.
Moray eels are affected.
And other fish even. I haven't seen it. Well, we've been diving in some of this cold stuff, and it's pretty hard to stand. I mean, I was in a wetsuit, and I know he didn't want one, and it had goosebumps this big. But
it's so cold it gives you a headache it comes in, a lot of times in a thermocline, there'll be a cold layer
on the bottom.
And then there'll be you can see the difference in the densities of the water. It's like an oil layer almost. You can see it.
Sort of squiggly, and just above that, it's warm.
It's warm right above that.
It really affects the behavior of the fish. I mean, and sometimes it actually stuns. I mean, think bigger fish, even groupers and things.
Since fish are cold-blooded and they take on the temperature of their surroundings, they don't have to feed when it gets so cold, when it gets to a certain temperature. And each fish, especially snappers, have their own temperature at which they shut off. Some fish will go ahead and feed on through a certain part of the cold while others won't. It's amazing. And then it'll get too cold and then they'll shut off. And then at sometimes you can catch fish in the cold water. It'll actually concentrate the fish. The fish that didn't migrate out of the area or couldn't because the eddy was too big, they'll go to the highest relief areas they can find, trying to get closer to the top. And the cold water will actually concentrate the fish. And sometimes they will bite, you know, if you can get on them in that kind of situation. They usually do really well.
What's the largest fish you have?
Fish had to be that grouper.
340 pound
grouper that I caught last November, November I think it was. Or December, the year before, was the biggest one I had caught was 299 pounds. And that is just unbelievably lucky, really. We started fishing for those amberjacks on an area where It comes from 400 feet up to 265 on a big underwater cliff line. And we just put so many baits down trying to catch these amberjacks. We'll catch, you know, 30, 35 amberjacks in a day. And just one time, you get lucky enough to hit around one of these groupers and he bit the bait. Yeah, it took about a half hour to get him out. That's on the electric reel. That's the biggest fish now. Sharks. Caught some considerably bigger sharks. Tiger sharks around 1,000 pounds. But
now those are eating fish too.
The sharks in the last 4 years have become marketable. I don't deal too much with sharks because you have to be set up to deal with them. You know, they're not easy to catch and to handle at the boat. You should have a boom on the side of your boat, which when you get the shark up, you should shoot him or some kind of way to subdue him somewhat, and then the boom where you're able to put a big hook in his mouth and then hoist him up, and you can do all your cutting over the side, since you know you don't bring the whole shark in, you only bring in the part that you sell, which you cut them behind the head and down around their belly, and then cut their tail off, and they have to be bled right away. It's a little bit different. It takes a long time to deal with each fish, and they're not a real high-dollar fish as yet. And I catch a few of them, but most of the time it takes me so long. If I can catch one grouper that's worth, last year we got record prices for grouper. They're worth like $2.50 a pound. You know, and you catch a 20-pound fish, you know, that's $50-something, I guess, or somewhere around there. And the time you spend messing with a shark, you might have caught a grouper, and a shark is only worth $10, and the grouper's worth $50, so.
Where did you learn about, what do you call it, butchering fish?
Butchering, filleting,
okay.
Preparing.
Processing,
yeah. It was more or less just from watching other fishermen. You watch how they do it, and also on the pier when we grew up, that's where we learned how to do the filleting and stuff. But the actual how to deal with a shark, which is somewhat different than other fish, there was a Marine Extension agent, Frank Lawler. I don't know if you know him. Yeah, he has a booklet on how to prepare sharks for market. So. That's more or less how we learned to do that.
So, what were some of the first things that you remember worrying about when you went down?
I just remember I used to cut my finger a lot.
Yeah. I remember learning to fillet and skin fish on the pier, watching.
Skinning dolphin was probably one thing that we learned from different charter boat places. Because when we were kids, we used to fish around Oxley charter boats also at the docks. Because that was always a good place to fish, somewhere where they would clean fish, where other fish would congregate. We would, you know, as kids, we would fish around these docks. And we would see them come in and how they prepared their fish. And with the dolphin, they would just make a small slit along the top and right across by the belly and on down along all the way to the tail. And they would just actually pull the skin off without cutting it off like you have to do with most fish.
They pull it off with pliers or actually wrap a piece of the skin around their hand and yank it off in whole, and then they would fillet it. And their fillet would be ready to go after they'd removed the bones. But I've watched, like for instance, you go to another country and you watch people clean fish, and it's really an education because it's different. Every island or every port you go to, they're like in the Bahamas or most of the Caribbean or most developing countries, they don't fillet them,
they cook the fish.
Occasionally they'll cut the head off, but usually they just split it or gut it and cook the whole thing.
Yeah, there's a woman in Miami, a Haitian woman, who's just a phenomenal cook. And she has, kind of fish that basically you take out the insides and put in a lot of fresh vegetables.
Yeah.
And seasonings.
Yeah, I like to prepare fish that way.
Yeah.
But in the market, you know, most Americans are used to buying a fillet. And they really don't even care to see the whole fish. They would just as soon see just the fillet, you know, what they're going to eat, and not have to look at the eyes and everything.
Oh, yeah.
You
know? That's always been a big joke.
That's right.
But in Mexico, that's, you know, when they fish prepare fish either on the grill or fried. They'll just score the fish with a knife like four times down the side, put the whole fish in the frying pan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Put your butter on the plate and there it is.
Do you think that the tradition is dying out?
There's no doubt about it. Fishing is so much harder these days. You have to know so much. In order to stay in it now, you have to know how to catch, you know, almost everything that swims. And David and I, growing up like we did, we have a big advantage over someone who just wants to become a fisherman out of the blue, because
we stumbled through everything.
We learned from
the school of hard knocks, really. I mean, doing things maybe not quite the wrong way, but doing them, you know, learning by your own mistakes, not having it really in our families or anything. Somebody say, this is how you do it, this is where you go to catch them. It was, you know, you had to ask the questions.
It's all trial and error.
You had the trial and error.
You had to
test your own hypothesis.
No, that didn't work well. Will this work? Will this bait work? You know, this one will work sometimes.
And then something
this
works
work
and
another.
You think you've got it. You use that for a little while, and then you realize, boy, this, we could have been doing this much better had we been doing this. And
But you grew up in fishing communities. Now, your father was a golf teacher?
Yes, he was.
He was a businessman, a banker. And, I mean, he liked to go fishing with me, but I was the guide. I mean, I took him fishing, really. Wasn't he taking me?
How did your families react to, well, your dad obviously supported you, so did you have to drop you off?
Yeah, they thought it was great, you know, that I had that much interest in fishing. Sometimes I would get in trouble, like many times a fish, you know, like to bite right before dark, and I would not get home in time for dinner or something like that. And then I'd get placed on a restriction for going fishing, which, you know, was really bothersome. As far as I'm concerned, it was a great way to grow up. I wouldn't change it if I had to do it over again. It was,
man, the same. And we actually, I know both of us sort of parlayed it into, you know, we went to school and studied biology and studied fish in college, you know, whereas I could have probably been could have been any other professional type career that I wanted. We went through essentially pre-medical undergraduate programs, pre-dent, pre-vet, all that, just the basic zoology, so we could study fishes in graduate school, and we did that. Now, I mean, just basically driven by curiosity and interest, not any, which I shouldn't say I look at it as a mistake now, but no, it's not, but I mean, that's where it actually led me and him. And I always had support from my parents. They didn't, I mean, my dad would always, he'd look at me out of the corner of his eye, but.
Exactly. We held on to the tradition, but broke tradition in doing it.
Right.
You know,
and introducing the
new way of fishing.
To the commercial. But it's interesting that the live bait, the method's almost identical to what we're doing, except for the actual conventional tackle. The rods and reels are used in a lot of other places, not here, but like in California, they fish for tuna using chumming with live bait, using stiff poles and lines. It may be dying out there too, but in the South Pacific, that's how the natives fish. In fact, I went to a place in some islands in the Indian Ocean last year and found out that the natives there fish just like they had little primitive boats, but they fish for a type of skipjack tuna just like we did. They caught their bait, live bait, in traps, and they filled the bottom of the whole boat up with water and threw their live bait in there and kept them alive, went to the fishing grounds and had one guy do nothing but chum and bail water out of the boat while the other guys fished with hook and line, identical to what we're doing, and they've been doing it for centuries.
Yeah. Now, what are your rods made?
They're fiberglass, hollow fiberglass. And the reels are usually a pen 4-0. With about 50-pound test on it, 50 or 60.
Do you have any legal information?
Yeah, I think I've got.
I'd like to take some pictures of it.
Okay.
Other than that, once you've got some nice words and want to say to posterity, you can do more. Gosh, I wish I was at CSUN.
No, I think we covered it pretty well.